Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. It is the most sacred place on earth, the birthplace of the Lakota that has shaped thought, identity, and philosophy of the Ocheté Shakoan since time immemorial, the life-giving land known as the Black Hills. Yet with the arrival of the first Europeans in 1492, the sacred land has been the site of conflict between the people who nurtured it and the settler state seeking to exploit it and redefine it in their own image. Lakota Nation versus United States is a searing testament to the strength of the Lakota people and a visually stunning rejoinder to the distorted image of a people long shaped by Hollywood. The film again is Lakota Nation versus United States. We're joined today by the co-directors of the film, Jesse Shortbull and Laura Tomaselli. To both of you, welcome to Film School Radio.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm going to start with you, Jesse, because the inspiration for this film, how did this project come about? And with your history and in your family, as well as the tradition that you are a part of, what started this? What began this journey?
What's interesting there is on both sides of my family, I'm rooted to the United States military around the time of Little Bighorn on my mom's side of the family, who had a soldier who was actively fighting against Lakota Nation at the time. And then on my dad's side of the family, who was on the opposite side of the fence. So my two great-great-grandfathers were at war with one another. And lo and behold, here I am today. You know, I don't know if you could ask those two guys back then if, you know, they would see things being differently now with me being their descendant. But what I would say is that the conflict, the history is embedded in my DNA. Even though I, like a lot of other people across the United States, wasn't privy to a lot of the history. So in fact, this film was a learning journey for myself. It's actually helped me in a lot of ways to really appreciate our tribes and their sovereignty that they have. I think that what really started this whole venture, the little spark that started it all, was a news article that discussed the United States Supreme Court decision on the land claim that the Sioux Nation had against the United States. And it was a court claim that took generations of people to get to that landmark decision in 1980 by the United States Supreme Court. Just that alone, even in talking to one of our producers, his name's Benjamin, just the fact that how long it took, the fact that the court case itself barely even survived that time and had failed and took, as one of our participants said, a series of legal miracles to resuscitate. And so I think that the curiosity spawned from that news article helped us try to bring it into the fold for people both on and off the reservation to try and understand within a two-hour window, which Laura does so amazingly well, what was going on that time to lead to where we are today.
I'm tempted to leap ahead, you know, in terms of describing some of the things that are going on, but that decision is remarkable for all the reasons you just described it, but also the fact that they turned down the money because it was a huge settlement. I'll just leave it there. People can see in the film what I'm talking about. But the fact that they turned it down because they wanted their land back takes my breath away. Laura, where did you and Jesse, how did you become part of this enterprise?
That same producer that Jesse mentioned, which is Ben Hedin, who also worked on MLK FBI, he knew both of us and played a bit of matchmaker, definitely reached out to Jesse first. And then he knew, I think, that I had the capacity to sit alone in a room for 9 months and go through all the archival I could find. But in terms of Jesse and my first meeting, I think it's like a funny director first date, right? We were kind of nervously kind of sizing each other up, having our conversation, chain smoking in a parking lot of a Holiday Inn in South Dakota. And I think immediately we kind of, like, I felt like even if I didn't know all the information, I understood what Jesse wanted to do with the film. And I think we were pretty unified in our goals, which was to make a film that didn't blame people, that wasn't, we didn't want it to be finger pointing the whole time, but that we also really wanted to do justice to the history, to this history that has been undertold or, you know, mistold or lied about for so long.
And I can attest to just what you said, because I think I know a lot about American history. I've been around a while. I've seen a lot of documentaries, right? But I've never seen one that was as macro and micro as this one together. I think that's the thing people need to kind of take away or understand about this in our conversation is you get the unvarnished history of the Europeans' invasion of this land and the interactions that have taken place over the course of these last 200 years, 200 plus years, 300 years, and to understand that you have been told a whole lot of things, or that you weren't told and you watched movies. And that's why you think what you think. And I think this does a remarkable job of walking down kind of this checklist, if you will, of grievances, of atrocities that have been committed against the indigenous people of this land. So congratulations just on that alone, and for a lot of other reasons. But let's talk about Lakota. Let's talk about the Black Hills. Why is this land considered to be such an integral part of the history of the Lakota?
Since the time I was a young boy, and even with a lack of understanding about adult things and things of that nature, I think that, and even without any historical understanding, it was very apparent to me growing up that the Black Hills were viewed as a sacred place. And I, even though I didn't understand it, somehow that shred of belief permeated me as a child. As I come to grow older and understood just how revered it was by not just Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribes, but a multitude of tribes throughout the region. Several tribes, such as the Kiowa, Cheyenne, Arapaho, Crow, Mandans, Hidatsas, have a reverence for the Black Hills. For us, I think that, again, it's the culture and it's the place of, as Milo Yellowhair in the film put it, just it's the birth of our nation comes from this land, and it's embedded in the land throughout. There are seven principal sites throughout the Black Hills, which correlate through seven stars in the sky. So there's an immense knowledge of the land and how it pertains to us and how we're linked to one another. The land is linked to us and we are linked to that land, and the condition of the land also reflected in the condition of our nation.
This is a little bit philosophical, what I'm about to say, but there is something about getting through this period of the human experience moving forward as we sit here today in 2023 that is so much dependent upon the indigenous experience of being connected to the land, understanding the land, understanding basically how we're going to survive these next 100 or 200 years or whatever it is in store for us. There is something about that philosophy and that way of life that has been dismissed, diminished in our perception. And now we need that more than ever. And I think there's some, I don't know where I'm going with this, except to say there is a certain degree of affirmation in the time we're living in as to the way of life that you're talking about. In terms of, you know, going into this, we were talking about what you knew and what you learned over the course of this, making this film. I'll just say one or two things that's jumped out at me that I was kind of aware of, but not really to the degree until I saw this film. Killing of the buffalo and the impact it had on Indigenous people. And there were a couple other things, but that is one. But what did you not know anything about or sort of misunderstood that you learned over the course of making this film?
I think there's a lot of answers to that question, but Funnily enough, I think the thing that is jumping out at me, it actually has to do with the reception of the film, which is that I think I had this idea that this is a history that's been kept from non-Indigenous people only, that we didn't learn in schools. But I think what has proven to be true in all the reservation screenings, even what Jesse's saying, is a lot of pieces of this, no one has been taught deliberately, you know? So it's like, of course, Dakota 38, I didn't know about until I, you know, until I read Lely's poem. I think I'd known about the extermination of the buffalo, certainly not to the detail that I know now, you know, and certainly not connecting the dots with the goal of the extermination of the buffalo. We had a much longer segment in the film, you know, that really went into how there were these buffalo hunts that would happen from trains. I mean, people would come from New York and they would be on a train with a gun and they would just drive through and just shoot as many buffalo as they could. And so that detail's not in the movie, hopefully, like the degree, the extent of the extermination is, but a lot of stuff for me, I learned a lot about.
Boarding schools, I knew of. Yeah. We've just recently heard about the Canadian version of that. But this, and I guess what is impressive about the film for me is there's, to me, the way that this has been presented in the past, there was sort of a passivity to the history. Like there was no actors involved, right? It just sort of happened. But then when we talk about what happened at Mount Rushmore, the deliberative nature of the imposition of this violence on these people, right? That's the shocking part of, for me.
I think if you look at Lakota worldview and the violence that was put down upon us and how it was so brutal that, and Lely writes it so well, you know, at one time it was, you know, combat. It was fighting. It was bullets. It was soldiers. And then it became something that a killing from the inside out. Self-hatred that came from the boarding school era, I think that almost could have really destroyed Lakota culture, but it is so resilient and so strong that despite that massive attack, and that the attack is still ongoing because we still do things that are counter Lakota culture to one another, violence upon one another. But I think that if we can get back to something really special like we had before the boarding school, that's where we're really going to thrive. Yeah, no, it's, and I think that the boarding school, which, you know, continued up until the 1970s, and maybe even in some places a little bit longer than that, the Western movie was also, you know, the principal thing. And so that also played a role in the self-hatred that a lot of people perceived themselves as, even though it was wrong. Yeah. It was a lie. But I think, you know, we are at a unique time right now. And it's a time to understand. It's a time to look back. It's time to see what went wrong and what can we do now to put us in a good position.
By the way, I want to remind our listeners, we're talking about the documentary film Lakota Nation versus United States. And we're speaking with the co-directors, Jesse Shortbull and Laura Tomaselli. And it's coming out this week, by the way, being released through IFC Films, coming out this week in Los Angeles. So be looking for it. In the film, there's a lot of treaties. A lot of treaties were signed. Let's talk a little bit about that part of the story. The government of the United States made a deliberate decision about how to take over this land. And it was dependent upon signing treaties, which is something I knew nothing about.
And I'm going to answer this shortly and then hand it to Mr. Shortbull. I think that from the outset, we sort of knew that we had the burden of proving that treaties really mattered today. They've always mattered, but they matter today. Because I think, again, we're talking about gaps in the education system. Like, I never saw a treaty. You know, my conception of treaties is maybe between other countries, but never within ours with different sovereign tribal nations, because we've deliberately not taught this. In terms of integrating it into the film, we were very lucky in that, in terms of Lely Longsoldier's work, who we're leaning on quite a bit, she had sent through, we're using two of her poems in the film. One is 38, which was already written, and the other one is 135 X's, which she wrote for the film. That locked so many things into place, I think, for both, yeah, of them, both visually, both as motif, both as structurally, even the way that she parses the treaty, the language of the treaty. Jesse says this well, where she looks at the words, the letters, the spaces between the words, turns it upside down every which way, like a poet can do. All of that was incredibly instructive in how we would prove that these really did matter. They've always mattered and they still matter today.
Yeah. And just to add on to that, in our treaty, specifically with the United States, it was drafted as it would be with a sovereign entity or, you know, like such as France or England. We were then changed from that sovereignty, which it was initially created as, to recognize that sovereignty. And then all of a sudden downgraded by them to classify us as wards of the state, from a sovereign nation to wards of the state. And only because we didn't go by the Christian belief system. We never, as a sovereign nation, never changed our side and our understanding, but they did. Everything, it's still very applicable. If you come onto the reservation, Mike, you sit in a tribal council meeting, this document from 1868, from 1851, yes, is cited in almost every meeting that you go to. It's a part of people, is a part of our tribal citizens' day-to-day lives, through their health care, their education. Outside of that, you step away from it, and the rest of the world looks at it as an antique, a scrap of paper, and you cannot find anything. We go to Rapid City, you can go to Mount Rushmore, Shrine of Democracy, but yet there is not a single place for anybody to access a treaty to understand how the Shrine of Democracy even came to be.
Yeah, those treaties became instruments by which they could justify the taking of property, the justification for the things that happened, which, yeah, that's just evil. There's just so much here. I've been talking a lot about big picture-ish things. The film has these wonderful people in the film who give us on the ground humanizing element in the film that brings all of this, these big picture things down into a very humanistic, humanizing kind of way. And I so appreciated about the way that you went about integrating all of these different elements. But it's those are the things that'll resonate with me long after the history lesson is the people that we see in the film.
I want to interrupt and say one thing that I've been thinking about since you talked about the facelessness of this. And I think that one of the things we've discussed is this film certainly has Western tropes. I think another thing that we wanted to dispel was obviously sort of talking about the propaganda of Hollywood, talking about, you know, who the good guy was, who the bad guy was, like Jesse was saying, that provokes even self-hatred in Indigenous people. But I think for me particularly as well, in terms of these activists, in terms of activism, in terms of resistance, we also look to superhero movie tropes, because I think when you see what these people are up against, when it's, you know, when you think about, again, like even movies like Star Wars, like there's a reason why in Indian country, I think that a lot of people like that movie, and it's because it's the Rebel Alliance against this big evil, you know. And
the Death Star.
The Death Star, exactly. And so I think for me, it was really about foregrounding these people as superheroes. When Crystal's on top of the water tower at the end of the movie, you know, it's impossible to not be like, yeah, you know? And so I think that was definitely a goal of ours. So it made me happy that you said that.
For people who care to watch this film, who should watch this film, I'm of the belief, no matter how horrible these events are in the context of history and our behavior, we need to know them. We're never going to get past this until we acknowledge these things and begin to make amends. I'm sorry, Jesse, you were going to say.
I agree with you. And that's one thing that I hear a lot is, oh, this happened in the past. You'll have to get over it. It is out of sight, out of mind for a lot of people. But for us, it never was out of sight, out of mind. Everything that was set in motion back then is still moving. The people that enacted some of those things, yeah, they're long gone and they're dead. They're moved, you know. But the devices that they set in motion are still running. And that's what we have to look at. Is how do we shut that device down? You said that's how we're going to grow together.
Well, congratulations to both of you for this wonderful work. And I'm so glad that it's going to get a full release and it's going to have an opportunity for a lot of people to see it. And The film is called Lakota Nation versus United States, and we've been joined today by the co-directors, Jesse Shortbull and Laura Tomaselli. Look forward to more work and another conversation somewhere down the line. So thank you so very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
Thank you. It's been awesome.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.